This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at acura.com.
KCRW has two winter sweepstakes that you could win. Don't miss out on your chance to drive away in an all-new 2007 Mini Cooper or win a five-night vacation in Paris. Go to kcrw.com/join for details.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Braudesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, what do Spider-Man, King Kong, and Malcolm in the Middle have in common? Special effects. Plus, the long history of short film. And the writer speaks again. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Don't go anywhere. It's The Business from NPR. Big news. The war over high-definition DVD formats has come to an end. In related news, the war over high-definition DVD formats rages on. The fact is that Hollywood wants you to pay more for better pictures and sound. The problem is Hollywood studios have been in an extended battle over two new rival DVD encoding formats. Half the town is getting behind the Toshiba-backed HD DVD, while Disney, Fox, and Sony are betting solely on Sony's Blu-ray DVD. Mind you, none of these amazing new DVDs are widely available yet, and HD players aren't exactly selling briskly either. That's because in addition to their being hugely expensive, consumers are justifiably wary of reliving our long national Betamax nightmare. As if all that wasn't confusing enough, a third hybrid format arrived last week called Total HD, which stores the two competing formats on one DVD. Meanwhile, those overstuffed gift bags for celebs who take part in Hollywood award shows will be measurably lighter this season. The IRS last week announced it had reached a deal with the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, making the outrageous swag-stuffed Golden Globes gift bags taxable income. The result? Last year's Golden Globe gift bag included a trip to Antarctica and a diamond ring valued at $40,000. This year's gift bag is reported to include a Greyhound bus ticket to Detroit and a box of Spearmint Tic Tacs. In other federal agency-related news, The Hollywood Reporter says that the FBI's new seminar, Crime Essentials for Writers, played well with the standing-room-only audience of executives and writers from several major and minor studios. Attendees learned that the major terrorist group aligned with Sunni Muslims is Al-Qaeda, while Shiite Muslims support Hezbollah. The demonstration went over so well that the FBI says it now plans to share its educational slideshow with the Bush White House, which is having major third-act problems with its Iraqi action-adventure screenplay. And finally, if you're exhausted by the violence in Baghdad, changing the channel from CNN won't help matters. Violence on broadcast television is approaching epidemic proportions, exploding by 75% in the last 6 years, according to the Parents Television Council, anyway. In a new report released last week entitled Dying to Entertain, the PTC said the 2005-2006 season was the most violent since the group began tracking the issue in 1998, with an average of 4.41 violent incidents each primetime hour last season. It's unclear whether the group included Tara Reid's botched boob job as an act of violence. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the show, the long history of short film. But next, special effects so special, you don't even know they're there. The reviews of Peter Jackson's blockbuster remake of King Kong often mention that the special effects were so good, even the hair on the monkey looked real. It is amazing what the wizards behind digital effects can do these days. But increasingly, there are effects where you'd least expect them. Mark Driscoll is the president and founder of Look Effects, a boutique effects company with a long list of credits that include the biggest, most effects-heavy films in history.
Mark Driscoll, welcome to the business.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
First of all, congratulations, because the Visual Effects Society announced their nominees, and a couple of the movies that your house slaved away on in its hay-filled cubicles.
Exactly.
We're among the list of nominees. So first of all, congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we were able to contribute some work to The Fountain, which was a great movie to be part of.
And also Blood Diamond.
And also Blood Diamond, exactly.
So you do a lot of effects on movies that we fully expect special effects to be integral to the storytelling. But you also work on a lot of stuff, especially in TV, that isn't intuitively effects-driven. Tell me about some of those.
Yeah, unlike those big visual effects movies that you'd think about, things like, you know, Blood Diamond, Apocalypto, we even did a lot of work on Rocky Balboa, 250-plus shots. We do a lot of visible effects, television in particular. A couple of the ones we've done are, you know, we actively do Bones right now, which is a series on Fox. We also did for a long time CSI New York. And what was unique about CSI New York is that, unlike what you think of, it's shot in Los Angeles. So a lot of the work that we were brought in to do was to make it look like it's actually supposed to be in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were doing a lot of adding cityscapes behind the live-action environments they're shooting here in Los Angeles. Smog removal. We actually did a whole sequence where they shot it in Marina Del Rey, which is right on the beach. And we put in Coney Island behind it, where all the, you know, apartment buildings are, such that you could have the illusion of them finding this dead body on Coney Island, right on the sand in Coney Island. So we did a lot of work there. And that's something that we're very proud of, is doing stuff where it goes right by, people don't notice it, and it's a huge story point bit for the, you know, for the directors and producers of the show, but nothing that you would necessarily see and think, oh, that's a visual effect shot.
So the obvious question I should ask you here is, you've just created Coney Island, which exists.
Yes.
And you could just turn on a camera and there it would be. Is it not cheaper, or is it just unfeasible, if that's a word?
Yeah.
Is it not feasible to just go do this? Why do we have to sort of reinvent the wheel?
I know exactly what you're saying. It's interesting.
Means of making a living.
In normal day, maybe 10, 20 years ago, you just pick up the entire first unit crew and you go to Coney Island. But given the speeds of these shoots, especially in television, for a show like CSI New York or Malcolm or Bones, you're talking, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 days to shoot an entire episode. They don't have the ability to necessarily move the entire crew there, or part of a second unit crew there to shoot these elements. So what we're doing is it's by no means cheap, but it's a lot cheaper than moving the whole entire unit there and flying these big name actors over to Coney Island to do this stuff. And so what we're able to do is we're able to give the producers and the writers the flexibility to shoot here and get more time with their actors and spend more money on what they see on the screen, but give them the scope of a different environment than they could necessarily find here in Los Angeles.
Well, a friend of mine who works in visual effects used to say, you know, fast, cheap, good, pick any two.
Well, now they want all three. They definitely cheap is important. And we try to be as cost effective as we can. I mean,
what does Coney Island cost if I want to throw it on a beach in Marina Del Rey?
Coney Island was not that expensive. It was about $4,000 to do one of those shots. But it could have been cheaper. We were able to, strangely enough, use stock footage off the internet. I think we just took stills from the internet. It wasn't actually any footage that was actually shot. And then we added life to it. We put a CG, computer-generated roller coaster, on the actual still image of the roller coaster to give a little bit of depth to it. You add some film grain to it. Maybe you add something silly like a bird flying through the sea, and all of a sudden you've got a dynamic background that was built off of a still you found on the internet.
That's really crazy. Tell me about Malcolm in the Middle. It's one of your credits here. What had to be done there?
That's a great show. I mean, that's a really unique comedic show we worked on for about 4 years. And it's really neat because a lot of the visual effects there were invisible to the extent that they were really supposedly helping to build the story points. We did a whole sequence out at what was supposed to be Burning Man out in the desert, where they basically blew up an RV and had a whole bunch of people standing around it as the RV was catching on fire. Now, obviously, they couldn't do that in real life with all the actors and all the extras standing right around the RV. So all that was – we cloned people to be around the RV and the place where the fire was, and we made the RV, you know, be on fire in the computer world.
Damn child safety laws.
Exactly.
Ridiculous. Is it easier in some ways to do these what you would call invisible or supporting effect shots because people aren't looking for them? People go to Superman, they go to Pirates, and they, you know, they want the bar to be raised, you know, and they want to be blown out the back door of the theater. There's sort of no expectation here.
It's definitely, I mean, putting a background, an extra background in or changing the background is definitely easier than, you know, the octopus in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Sure.
But it has to be done right, and that's the real trick. With the cost going down of computer equipment and software, people gravitate to, well, anybody can do this now. It's a commodity business. Yet the reality is that in order to make that background sit in there right and make it look like it's really authentic and you're actually really in Coney Island or in New York or wherever you need to be, that has to be planned out really carefully. It needs to be storyboarded, it needs to be designed, and it needs to be executed correctly. And there's a lot of back and forth with the production because you're often limiting yourself with what you have in your background to help define what foreground element you need to shoot. And so often we're finding an element we can shoot and then guiding the first unit crew as to how they should go about shooting it such that the two fit in right, or else you're going to end up with something that just looks like it was a hodgepodge.
The idea that we'll fix it in post just doesn't apply. It's really more collaborative.
Exactly, especially if you want to keep the cost down.
I'm wondering, you know, there are obvious, as you were saying, savings in not schlepping a whole crew out to the East Coast and shooting Coney Island, let's say, or in this case, you were talking about Malcolm in the Middle blowing up the RV. But has the cost of the very fact that you can blow up an RV digitally, has that raised the cost of television? Does it cost more to do this stuff? I mean, I recognize that actually blowing up an RV, not on the table, not in the cards for the show, but the fact that you can do this by itself, is it just making television that much more expensive?
I don't think so. I mean, what we hear over and over again is costs are going down and down and down and down and down. And so we're actually being brought in to do more stuff than we would normally have done in the past. It's strange that with the budgets going down across the board for all the television production, there's more and more work for visual effects companies in television. It's extremely competitive, but we're doing a lot of stuff that you wouldn't necessarily see. Somewhat for the fix it and post reason. You know, you can even do things with facial replacement, you know, cleaning up actors' faces along the way. You know, you may not want to take the extra time to shoot that next take because the makeup may be a little bit off. But that's okay. You like that take? We'll clean it up later on. We'll take out the little dimple. We'll fix the wig line, whatever it needs to be to make that shot be perfect. And that is cheaper than necessarily spending the time burning the film and allows you to keep moving on and keep moving forward. Mm-hmm. We're helped by the fact that the cost of our tools have gone down drastically over the years. I mean, something when we started Look, it was, you know, 10 years ago and cost of equipment was tenfold where it is now at least. Mm-hmm. And now we can buy, you know, Mac desktops from from CompUSA for $5,000 as opposed to $30,000 or $40,000 for hardware, you know, 10 years ago.
Mark Driscoll is president of Look Effects and works on all sorts of movies from Rocky Balboa to The Fountain and to TV shows that you wouldn't necessarily expect, including Malcolm in the Middle and Everwood. Mark, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks very much for having me.
A postscript. After our interview, I was speaking with Mark about some of his other recent projects. To give the fight scenes in Sylvester Stallone's Rocky Balboa an authentic feel, Look Effects took the crowd from a real fight in Las Vegas and overlaid it over one of the film's staged fights. Turns out, Stallone was actually at the real fight they used. So, if you watch Rocky Balboa very carefully, you can see Sly simultaneously in the ring and in the audience. Coming up next, the long history of short film. Short films have been around as long as film has been around, and they've been recognized by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences since the fifth Oscars in 1932. But the genre has gone through a metamorphosis, from popular entertainment to an often esoteric art form and calling card for would-be directors. One of the results of that change is that these days, most people never see many short films, even those nominated for an Academy Award. But for the second year in a row, Magnolia Pictures and Shorts International will bring a feature-length presentation of all the Oscar-nominated live-action and animated shorts to select U.S. theaters before the awards are handed out. We suggest you check them out, if for no other reason than it'll give you a leg up on your Oscar pool. To talk a bit more about these short films, we're joined by John Bloom, chair of the Academy's Short Films and Feature Animation Branch. John Bloom, welcome to The Business.
Pleasure to be here.
Give me a short history of shorts.
I'll try to make it short, but the history of shorts is just about as long as the movie business, because it's fascinating to realize, and of course very logical and understandable, that every innovation that ever took place in making films, including the very first films that were ever made, were shorts. Features, of course, evolved in the late 19-teens with D.W. Griffith, and then they started making longer movies. But in the beginning, everything was a short. And, they've evolved as has the movie business, but sound and color and everything was first in shorts.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, serials in the 30s and 40s, Flash Gordon and all of that kind of stuff were, in essence, shorts that ran week after week. And going to the movies was a whole evening event. It was a double feature. It was a series of shorts. It was newsreels, which are also shorts. It was early music videos, which were performances, which were shorts. And all of these things evolved and grew into different aspects of the movie business. But in those days, the 30s, 40s, even into the 50s, shorts were part of a long package of material offered to the public and were even advertised on the billboards and were part of what drew audiences to spend their 5 hours at the movies seeing this panoply of material, including double features.
So when does the short sort of go into decline?
Well, as the movie business evolved, as television began to compete with it, the feature exhibition business began to become more oriented around a single film, more oriented around getting an audience in, getting them out, cleaning the theater, and loading them in for the next screening. And the theaters and the studios today want to show trailers if they show anything at the head of a film.
Let's talk about this new world we're living in, this world of a $1.65 billion deal for YouTube.
Is YouTube going to allow someone to, you know, make a short and make back their money? I sure hope so, because whether they're Academy shorts or not, I'm an enormous fan of shorts. I'm a short filmmaker myself, a former Oscar nominee for producing and directing a short myself as well.
But I guess what I'm asking is there a tension there for you guys? I mean, you're at the Academy. You're about preserving film and about the theatrical experience. People, butts in seats, buttered popcorn, shared experience. YouTube is everything that you could say is antithetical to the filmic theatrical experience. Does that worry you?
Well, I think it's a different medium potentially. I think it's very much, as you're referring, an evolving medium. But no, it doesn't worry me. If we get to a point where the theatrical experience is no longer viable for whatever the reason is, that's a foundational question. Is YouTube going to signal the end of that? First of all, I don't think we know, because I think the YouTube phenomenon is very much still evolving. And as you said, I think it's really a different experience.
Now there's been some discussion within the Academy about whether or not shorts should even stay an Oscar category. The thinking is that our shining moment comes once a year, the Oscar telecast. This is Hollywood's chance to put its best face forward. Why waste it on these movies no one's seen? Is that the argument?
That's one of the very fair arguments that have been raised opposing why the short should be on the show. And it's one of the reasons why I'm ecstatic about the burgeoning opportunities to get the shorts out there. I've been an Academy member for over 20 years. Very active in supporting and defending the branch within the Academy, which hasn't always been easy. Suffice it to say that I believe now the Academy embraces the shorts and recognizes their importance. And part of that turnaround has come from the fact that we are trying hard to get the shorts out there.
John Bloom is a filmmaker, a trailer maker, and a member of the Board of Governors on the Motion Picture Academy. John, thanks for being on The Business.
Been my pleasure.
Coming up after a short break, The Writer Speaks again. You're listening to The Business from NPR.
This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. The Writers Guild Foundation and Tall Fellow Press have published a book called Doing It for Money: The Agony and Ecstasy of Writing and Surviving in Hollywood. It's filled with essays from successful writers about the business of writing for film and TV. In the fifth installment of our ongoing series we call The Writer Speaks, Bruce Joel Rubin came down to our studio to talk to us. He's written big Hollywood films like Stuart Little 2 and Deep Impact, but he's perhaps best known for supernatural stories like Jacob's Ladder and Ghost, for which he won an Oscar.
My whole life has basically been a kind of pursuit of what's out there on some level beyond what's normally seen. And since I was a kid, and it exacerbated in the drug-addled 60s, and I really just started pursuing things. And then when I finally decided to write, I knew that's what I had to write about. I began meditating very early in my life, and I began sensing that there was another world out there in the stillness that very few of us ever experience in our life because we're so totally drawn to the noise, and that the secret of life seems to be in getting out of the noise. And so that's what I really tried to do, and from that came a lot of stories. Working in the noise of Hollywood is actually a wonderful training ground, and I love it. I you know, if you want to deal with ego noise, which is the biggest noise we have in our head, it's kind of constant chatter. Hollywood amplifies that beyond anything I've ever experienced anywhere except maybe in Washington, D.C., because it's just your brain that's creating all of that stuff. It's your ego saying, I matter, I'm important, I want to be important. Why did they get that deal? Why didn't I get that deal? As soon as you get caught up in that, it's over for you. You're just playing a game. You're in that thing of reading Variety every morning and just wanting to crawl under the table, and that's not the way to live. When I won my Oscar, I realized on some level it was a truly extraordinary moment. I really had gotten the thing that I had gone in search of as a kid, that kind of whatever specific recognition of attainment, and then realized that this gift was an enormous, enormous problem, because now I had to live up to that attainment. I had to now produce for people who had every expectation that I was going to give them an Oscar-worthy script the next time and the next time and the next time. The truth is, no writer knows what's going to come out when they sit down to write something. Jacob's Ladder was a very visual movie, and I saw it as I wrote it as a very, very particular and very visual movie, something I would call perhaps Spielbergian, you know, really very large and full of special effects. And then I met Adrian Lyne, who directed it, and Adrian he hates special effects. He didn't want to do one single special effect in the whole movie, and I was really thrown by that because the movie was full of those images. He said, we're going to do it all practical. And then he looked very closely at a line that I had written. It was, the wall disappears, and beyond it we see a vision of the void. And Adrian looked at me and said, Bruce, how many carpenters do I need to build the void? That was very instructive to me, and it has proven to be one of the basic things that I've learned in writing now, that, you know, a director has to have a vision, and he has to build that vision. A writer can have any vision and doesn't have to build it beyond putting words on a page.
Here's Bruce Joel Rubin reading his essay called Script Advice from Beyond the Grave.
In the spring of 1984, my wife Blanche quit her job at Northern Illinois University, put our house on the market, and announced we were moving to Hollywood. She knew I would die if I did not pursue my dream of becoming a screenwriter. That June, we arrived in Los Angeles with our two young sons and enough money to live for 2 months if we were frugal. Robert M. Sherman, a producer friend, called me soon after with a possible screenwriting job, adapting a novel called Friend. It was a bizarre story about a young boy who builds a robot. The boy's next-door neighbor is a teenage girl he secretly is in love with, who is badly treated by her abusive father. One day, the father throws her down a flight of stairs, and she is pronounced brain dead at the hospital. In despair, the boy decides to do brain surgery on the young girl, using his robot brain to bring her back to life. To his astonishment and ours, he succeeds. Unfortunately, the girl comes back as a crazy person and goes around killing all the people who have done her wrong. I turned the job down, certain I had not come to Hollywood to write this kind of stuff. I'd rather starve. The next morning, I was sitting and meditating as I do every morning. As I observed my wandering mind, I could see that I was still feeling smug about walking away from the project and proud that I was maintaining my integrity in Hollywood. At that very moment, I heard a voice, the voice of my meditation teacher, Rudy, who had died 11 years before. Calling through the ether, he yelled, "Schmuck!" There's more integrity in feeding your family than in turning down jobs. He then insisted that I get up from my cross-legged position, go to the phone, and call the producer. It was 7 in the morning, and I thought too early to call anyone. But then again, I don't often get directives from beyond the grave. So I hobbled to the telephone, woke the producer, and lied that I had found a way to make this a worthy film and would like the job. He said he was delighted, and I was hired. Then, extraordinary things began to happen. I worked very hard to give the script some human dimension, and when I finished, a vice president of Warner Brothers called me. She said that she was amazed that the script had made her cry. Actually, I was amazed too. The movie attracted Wes Craven as the director, and it was a delight to work with him. While the movie was shooting, I was able to bring my wife and boys to the Warner's lot, and we all luxuriated in the excitement of being in the movie business. Ari, my youngest son, he was 5 then, became a mascot on the set. He fell in love with Christy Swanson, who played the girl next door, and she was sweet enough to recognize his adoration and take him on his first date to McDonald's. He is now 24 and has never forgotten it. Unfortunately, when the movie previewed for a Wes Craven audience, they hated it. They had not come for an emotional experience, and panicked studio brass decided that we needed to put in more gore, 6 more scenes to be exact, each bloodier than the one before. We did. And at the next preview, the audience was propelled out of its seats, literally standing on top of them, screaming with unbridled excitement and bloodlust. They especially liked the old lady who had been decapitated by a basketball, running headless through her house, sprouting torrents of blood from her neck. Not surprisingly, the film was given an X rating for excessive horror. With each horrific frame that was cut from the movie, Wes said that we were losing another $1 million at the box office. It turns out that the film made only about $9 million, so you can imagine how many frames were cut out. I was pretty ashamed of the final product and wondered why my teacher had journeyed from the netherworld to encourage me to do it. But there is a happy ending, actually, a few happy endings. Because the film got made, I got a bonus, and that bonus was the down payment for our house. My son Joshua was about to have the first peanut butter and jelly bar mitzvah in all of Los Angeles and was spared that humiliation by the sale of my script. And finally, a year later, in the 4th month of a horrible writer's strike, when my bank account had dwindled to $400 and we were fearful of losing our home, I got my first residual check for what was now called Deadly Friend. I looked at it and saw $3,500 and was wide-eyed with excitement. I kept thanking Rudy, my teacher, for making me take the job. Then my wife looked at the check and gasped. She told me that I had miscounted the zeros. It was actually $35,000. Deadly Friend had saved our lives. There is a moral to this tale. Don't turn down jobs in Hollywood. Take whatever the universe offers gratefully, and then do your best work. You might also try meditating. It wouldn't hurt.
Who is it?
If you enjoy being really scared, if you're not afraid of the unknown, if you've found a friend in fear, then we have a friend for you.
Hi.
She's killing people. Mom? Sam? Sam.
You're so cute.
Deadly Friend. She can't live without you.
And that's The Business. Matt Holtzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
You've been listening to KCRW's The Business. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including The Treatment, a weekly conversation with some of the most influential and innovative people in movies and popular entertainment, hosted by film critic Elvis Mitchell. Check out the podcast of The Treatment at kcrw.com.